Welcome to Discover Indie Film. I'm your host, Jeff Howard, and I'm very excited because I've got someone on Zoom with me, Matthew Domenico. Hey, Matthew.
Hey, Jeff. How's it going?
I am good. All right, so the disclaimer's in the front. As I said, we're on Zoom, and I've noticed it's funny when you listen back to a conversation that's recorded on Zoom. Sometimes people who normally would never talk over each other do because there's a micro delay. So for everyone listening, if you're mad about us speaking over each other or if you're mad about the sound quality, don't blame us, man. It's technology. It's Zoom. That is my technical disclaimer. Now let me just introduce Matthew. This is very fun for me because for those who don't know, I program two film festivals. And I first met Matthew in June of 2022 at Film Invasion Los Angeles. We accept screenplays, unproduced screenplays for these festivals. And it's actually highly competitive. I don't think a lot of people know this, but we get more scripts per official selection than we do films per official selection. So like being an official selection screenplay, like that means the people who read the scripts, because I don't read the scripts. I have like 700-800 films to watch. So clearly I'm not going to have the time to read them. But anyway, so your pilot, Nut to Butt, that you and Catherine Connor Duff co-wrote. But anyway, so Nut to Butt, which is a rad title, but for those who don't know, it's a military reference. That was an official selection for a pilot screenplay. And then half a year later, we have Film Invasion every June, and we have the Sherman Oaks Film Festival every November. And you showed up again. I saw you in person at a mixer, and you were there with another screenplay, Contact 360, which was an official selection for screenplay short film. And that one, I believe you wrote by yourself.
Yes.
And then of all the cool things, I've started a fun thing called TV High. It's a smart TV app and or streaming service, whatever you want to call it. It can be on your smart TV right next to the Netflix app. And TV High, TVHI, is something I've been sending emails out to official selection people like Matthew saying, hey, if you got anything that might be good to watch, Stone, just feel free to send it in. Because TV High, yeah, you know, the website is Watch TV High. And it's sort of just a fun, you know, I watched so many films for the festivals that occurred to me that, you know, we really need a streaming service that caters to the person who can responsibly enjoy drugs. Lord knows, I have friends in recovery. I hope everyone takes it seriously that you have to watch out for your health. But if you can, in a healthy way, incorporate legalized pod or whatever you can do that doesn't harm your life, the smart TV app TV High is for you. But anyway, Matthew sent over a couple films, and one of the films was If I Were to Speak of War, and I watched it and I'm like, this is just an excellent, wonderfully written, wonderfully acted, wonderfully directed short film that I think we both would agree is not great for the intended TV High audience. So I threw you an email and I'm like, how about we add it to the Discover Indie Film TV series that goes up on Prime? And now I've done, I think, enough introduction for Matthew Domenico. So happy to have If I Were to Speak of War join the Discover Indie Film family. And hey, you count anyway, because like normally a film has to come through Film Invasion in Los Angeles or Sherman Oaks Film Festival to end up in the series. But hey, you were in both festivals with scripts. So as far as I'm concerned, you're one of my guys. You're one of my people. So,
yeah, and thank you so much for that opportunity. I mean, it is so incredible. I don't know how many times I've been told, you know, shorts never go anywhere, or you know, if anything, it'll be a calling card for you. But like you said, like you know, people do put a lot of time. They put a lot of art, a lot of emphasis into it. And sometimes, you know, I've heard so many great storytellers and writers, and just you know, makers of the industry say, what is the best way to tell this story? And you know, when it comes to short films, like where do they go afterwards? So like getting this opportunity, when I like reached out to, you know, the cast and crew, they were completely mind blown. They were just like, what? Oh my God, that's amazing. So yes, so definitely thank you for you know, taking us in. That really means a lot. Thank you.
Hey, thank you for sharing a great film with me. You know, I appreciate every filmmaker who is grateful to be in the series I appreciate the gratefulness, but I am equally grateful to see this stuff. And honestly, you know, obviously I started the TV series on Prime because I learned about it. And I was like, you know, it's a crime because a lot of the times I like the shorts better than like it's, there's just so many wonderful shorts and people don't see them. And once we went on Prime Video, like we climbed up to like 10,000 viewers per week, like unique viewers. And then Amazon noticed us and said, oh, we don't like cutting you a check. So yes, the TV series costs 99 cents an episode or $7.99 a season. But all I can say is you're spending $8 for 10 episodes. That's like 20, 25 plus indie short films. I mean, you're spending $8 to support like 25 people whose art is their passion. So
exactly.
It's $8 well spent. I mean, as people often tell me, that's half a movie ticket on like bargain night.
Yeah. And not only that too, like the short film market is surprisingly like making like, I don't think it's ever been this popular. Like, I don't even want to call it a comeback. Like, it's like you're starting to get a lot of short films to the point where, you know, on Netflix, they have, you know, their two series, Love, Death, and Robots. And I think it's 2-minute horror stories, but you're also getting short stories on airplane airlines now. Like, yeah, it's becoming like a thing.
It is. And it's funny. Yeah. Cause Netflix does it the smart way where you like focus on a genre, whether it's sci-fi or horror. It's funny. Cause when we got booted off of, not that this one, we should talk about your film, but as long as we're talking about the series, like when Amazon moved us from included with Prime to having to charge, I approached the, you know, the streaming networks, the streaming services that have advertising in them. So it could be free still. Like, I guess I shouldn't name them. There's many and people know who they are. And everyone there, their first response was, oh, an anthology of shorts. What's the percentage of its horror? And I was like, well, it just so happens that we've got out of 150 films in the first six seasons, we've got 4 horror films and then a whole bunch of art house and drama and comedy. Cause I just love the variety, you know?
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, that's the whole point of a good festival, in my opinion. I mean, even then, if you're going to like a sci-fi specific short film festival, even a horror short film festival, there's going to be a variety to it. You know, I don't want to sit there and just binge the same thing over and over again. I want a plethora of storylines, a plethora of ways to tell different ways of the genre, not just one specific style. So yeah, let's be honest. There's a lot of marketing things happening lately that is just mind-boggling. Deadline is literally like, I don't even need drama in my life anymore. I just go to Deadline. I'm like, what happened now?
It is, and you're totally right. But then again, what you said about horror totally makes sense because you're creative. So you're looking for creativity. So yeah, it's always great. It's funny, one of the films in Discover Indie Film, I think it's season, I shouldn't name the season, I can't have them all memorized, but it's a film where a woman opens the door and there's a heart balloon floating in front of her and it comes into her apartment and they start dancing and drinking and then it kind of gets weird. And horror festivals embraced it because it was a nice breath, you know, it's not a series of jump scares. It actually is like creative and original with horror. And, you know, It is a funny world we live in where obviously everyone is chasing the next must watch, must binge series. And they're leaning on true crime and this and that just to lure us in. But in the end, I think the majority of people want to see something original. And, you know, in order to pay the however many billions of dollars Disney and Netflix needs to make per year, they've got to give us the least original stuff they can come up with, I think.
Yeah, no, it's definitely, I do think there is a absolute crave and desire to see original things and not even, and I think original is the most subjective word today. Like, what does original mean now? Because you can literally just sit there and be like, this is sequence writing. I know exactly what movie this is that I'm watching right now. And it's something from the 1980s or the 1940s being repackaged and resurfaced for today. And then, oh, well, that's original because we did this and did that. And it's like, well, I don't know if I would call that original, but it's all about audience viewership. Like you were saying, it's all about those binge numbers right now, to which I don't necessarily, I don't personally agree with that. Like, cause like sometimes like there's a number of shows getting canceled right now that off of season one, I'm so surprised, just like either do have good numbers or they're critically acclaimed, but they're getting knocked off season one. And I can just off the top of my head, I remember The Office. The American version, season one, had horrible numbers, and it didn't make an actual impact till season two. And then season three, it became this like national, international phenomena. So I don't exactly understand. I don't think anybody understands really what's going on right now. But that's the whole world, like the vibe with 2023. Like, yeah, we're just going to keep on tiptoeing our way through everything until eventually something's going to happen.
It is. And you're totally right. Yeah. Network, when there were three networks, they had time to let stuff grow. Seinfeld took more than a first season to really find its legs. Cheers was like not an instant hit. All this stuff was not an instant hit. And now not only do you have to be an instant hit, but their numbers are so accurate. That they know, you know, and I imagine, I mean, I understand capitalism. It's just where capitalism meets art is a rough spot, because, you know, but thank God there's still stuff like, you know, I love the show Atlanta, and I don't know how Atlanta has survived this many seasons. I think they've just wrapped it up, but the level of creativity there, I'm like, man, thank God somebody figured out how to succeed with something original in this marketplace. But it's a weird time. And I guess we are dealing with the fact that we switched from movie studios and TV networks to streaming. And then, you know, Lord knows COVID locked us all inside and it was no more theatrical. And boy, anyone who works at I have friends who work at streaming networks, and they're like, I think it was something like The Office and Friends represented 40% of Netflix's web traffic. Like 2 in 5 people were only watching those two shows. Like, you know, and I don't know how you're going to come up with another 200-300 episode half hour sitcom, because they won't give it the time, right?
Yeah. And I think that's the reason why we're in this weird sequence writing thing going on, where people are trying to, because eventually all these, you know, this is like my conspiracy theory of what happened. Basically, you know, Netflix, as everybody remembers, it was one place, it was a one-stop shop, and it was a phenomenon. And then it was a public stock, and then people just saw it go through the freaking roof. So you had FANG, you know, Facebook, Apple, Netflix, Google. And now these other companies wanting to boost their stocks, oh, well, we're going to take our own content, and you started getting these platforms. And then because of that happening, when they did it, they realized, oh, we don't have as much as the other guy, or we need something more. So you had this complete boom of content. Like, you even had showrunners going to Netflix and having the joke that, oh, yeah, like things were getting green lit in the waiting room of the Red Room pitch. Like, it was just like things were just going that quick, but nobody was actually saying, you know, is this script ready to go? Or does it need like a third or fourth draft? And, you know, this one is like being really slept on. And I think because of, and then that's usually a bull market. Like, everything's expanding. You start getting yes to a lot of things. And right now we're experiencing a bear market. Everything is constricting. So it's becoming a lot more competitive. And I think this is where specifically the indie community really can make so many moves of showing how much they can work with on the littlest amount of money, you know, actually, you know, good producers finding those, you know, those diamonds that have not been discovered for whatever reasons, in screenwriting, directing, cinematography, and just using everything they can within their means. And then boom, it completely like surprises people. Like, I don't know how many times I've been to a festival where I'm going up against people with like $50,000 budgets, and I had $5,000. And I feel like I'm going up against the Netflix and Amazon of that festival. It's like, oh my God, they had how much for production, and then they had this much for marketing. But even then, you know, we would walk away you know, with the same amount of awards in a different category with that big budget. And that's why I've always been a champion of, it starts with a script. Make sure the script is awesome to begin with. You know, it's really, you know, you picked it apart and you really spent time with it, finding those actors and really creating that ensemble team that I think the industry hasn't really figured that out yet since coming out of COVID. It's still trying to figure out the legs of trying to figure out that symbiotic nature that you really a production set all needs to have. You can't, it goes to the saying, the weakest link in the chain will always be its downfall.
Always. All right. So you mentioned writing. I guess we should jump into your history. How did you get involved in the creative arts? Because I mean, here you are. The cool thing is, I know your email signature says actor, writer, producer. And now I've gotten to see you in all three roles.
Yeah.
with If I Were to Speak of War. Because by the way, I mean, your cameo in it is, it really stands out to me as good acting. So.
Thank you.
Yeah. So golf clap on that one, because you know, and I believe your co-writer appears, but not even her face, right? She,
yeah.
Great directing there, but I really appreciate the lack of ego, you know, in a way of not playing the lead roles and not making it about you two. So, anyhow, So what got you launched into? Were you always a creative kid?
All right, so this is like going to be like the longest story ever, but this is how it basically started with me. I always wanted to be an artist, but I had massive confidence issues growing up. Like I was that kid growing up where I would be on the football team, but I wasn't a part of the football team or the track team. I was always like that weird outlier. And I couldn't talk to people. Like I remember even like at the high school, like auditions, I would be in the back, like trying to get the courage to go put my name down the list and go and perform a monologue or whatever it may be, but I couldn't do it. And then it's a family tradition in my family to join the military. And that's a really long story, but like, that's how I got into the Marines after high school. And I was a 2nd Battalion, 3rd Marines, Fox Company, and I was a grunt, 0311 infantry. And if nobody if you're listening to this and you're still questioning what is infantry, pew, 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 that's me. That's what I did. and then I went on 2 deployments. I was in the Surge of 09. I got sent to the Gulistan Mountains where I patrolled the Bugi Boss and Black Pass. And then I was combat replaced to Bakwa, where I patrolled the 515, dubbed by CNN in 2009 as the world's most dangerous road. And then on my 2nd deployment, I went to Marja from 2010 to 2011. I was not part of D-Day. I was at the second wave to go in. And when I came out, you know, I had massive addiction problems with alcohol. I was just all over the place as a person, but I wasn't like wild, like committing crimes or anything. I was just really lost as a person.
And it sounds like you were self-medicating.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Just like it's like become a thing in the military that like you have, it's like a rite of passage. You have to go through your alcoholic suicidal phase. Like it's just like something that you have to go through when you first get out, which is, I know it's insane to think about, but, or even laugh about, but then again, too, hey, come join the veterans. You'll understand.
I mean, sometimes things are so grim and wrong that you have to laugh about it, right?
Like, exactly. I mean, there's the famous World War II saying, if you can't cry about it anymore, you might as well just laugh at it. So like, that is really like a, the ethos of veterans right there. But I was sitting in the Veterans Resource Center at my community college, and I was a cop for 3 months when I was in the military, because I had 6 months left of my contract, and that was like bare minimum training to go to Afghanistan. So what are they gonna do, train me for 6 months and then cut me loose? Like, no. So they said, hey, like, what do you want to do when you get out? And I was like, well, I want to be a cop, just like every other fucking idiot. And then they're like, okay, great. So you're going to go be a FAP-NP, Fleet Assistance Program, military police. So long story short, I literally got 2 to 3 weeks of like how to be a cop. That was my academy. Like, here's a book and how you fill it out. Here's your gun. We're going to mace you real quick. And then here are the keys to your cop car. Go patrol the base. And I learned in that 3 months how much I did not want to be a cop and how different it was from being a grunt. It was I used to call myself a counselor on patrol. It was very like I don't understand how guys get out and they become cops because it is such a completely different world from the two. And so when I left, I was kind of like in that weird place. Like, you know, I had this plan of being a cop. I got to experience it, really didn't like it. So what do I do? And then somebody walked into the Veterans Resource Center of my college and was like, hey, anybody want to audition for 12 Angry Men? And I was just sitting there like, what's that? And they're like, oh, it's a play. And I was like, a play, huh? Okay. Well, fuck it. So I went and I auditioned, and for whatever reason, Marty Ram, who was the department chair at my community college, she fell in love with me, and she came out of that, I forget the famous theater composer's name and the writer, but she came out of that chorus line, Dreamgirls, the guy who created those productions. She came out of that group. And so she was very, very knowledgeable to acting, to directing, to writing, everything. She kind of just like poured a lot into me. And then from there, I went and got my degree in New York City at Marymount Manhattan College. I got my BA in theater performance. I graduated. I did off-Broadway, regional theater. I did some Shakespeare in Europe, landed in Los Angeles. And in Los Angeles, you know, Los Angeles, I'll put it like this. I was telling this part of the story to one of my mentors, and he's like, you basically had a Taylor Sheridan moment. And I was like, well, like, what does that mean? Like, you hit your breaking point, you just couldn't do it anymore. And, you know, I kept on getting military roles. Like, I could do in my acting, at least back then, like A to M. Like, that was like my toolbox. And for some reason, my auditions, it was only A to B. I was only getting military auditions. And, you know, sometimes I would be in the room with such amazingly talented creatives, like this is going to go somewhere big. Like, you know, I'm reading the script, reading the breakdown. This is going to be a phenomenal script. But at the same time, you know, military or veteran war movies are often Golden Globe, Emmy, Oscar bait films. So you better believe everybody and their mom is going to show up too. So it's, I would always get pinned, but I was never, I was always the bridesmaid, never the bride. And especially when you're going up against actors from CAA, WME, like it gets definitely challenging when you come from a very small agency. And so for every one good audition you got, you had like 50 lined up right behind it that were just awful. And I hated it. And I'll never forget the audition that broke me was I went in for a commercial. Not gonna say the company's name, but I went in for this commercial, and you know, I'm reading the breakdown. I'm supposed to be on patrol in the Middle East. I got it, and the casting director was like, "You know, we want you for the audition to look in the camera and say oorah," and I was like, "Why?" I just remember just being like, "Why? I'm on patrol in the Middle East. Like, why?" And she was like, "Well, isn't that you say right before a battle goes off, you say oorah." And I just like had like a total Joaquin Phoenix walking the line moment where like I saw like my life flash before my eyes. And I was like, oh yeah, right before a battle, you know, I'm not going to, you know, take my death letters, put them underneath my pillow. I'm not going to have a private conversation with my friend or even desperately try to find a satellite phone and call my parents one last time. No, I'm gonna look off into the sunset and say fucking oorah. And I remember so walking the line ended for me, and I looked in the camera, I said oorah, and then I went outside and I called my agent, my manager, called everybody on my team, and I said, I kept on telling you I don't want to do these auditions anymore because they put me in a bad place, but you keep sending me out for them, so you're fired. fired all of them in one fell swoop, and I just started writing and producing on my own. And you know, and at the same time that I was writing and while this was happening, a lot of my frustrations with auditioning, I was really experimenting with my own writing, producing. And you know, my first play that I ever produced was a hit in the festival we were at. We were a festival darling, and I've learned, you know, to the point that I've been in the industry, I've come to learn a couple quotes and a couple experiences. And one of the things that I know is, you do this long enough, the industry will tell you what they want from you. And going off of this one production and just seeing how many doors opened, how many people wanted to start talking to me, things were leading towards, I got that in 1 month in comparison to my acting, which I might have got that in a year. So it was like, okay, like, if I do want to get a stable career, I know that's like what we all want, a stable career in the industry. I think maybe writing and producing is going to lead me to that. And now it's not that I don't act anymore, because I still kind of do, but I'm so busy with writing. And to be honest, I get so much more from the writing portion. And then, yeah, and that's the really long story of how I got here.
Yeah, not too long at all, honestly. And it obviously probably rings true to myself and anyone listening that as someone who actually, so I assume they would pull you in not just based on your look, but based on your resume attached to, would mention your service.
Yeah, I had like
and a little. Our culture has learned to respect people who serve, but Hollywood and the arts think there's just not much of a connection there, right? So.
Yeah, I mean
the level of bullshit that you saw was unbearable.
Yeah, no, it was just like it's almost like this romanticized version of what war is, or even a glorified version of what war is. Like, that's not what happens over there. And you know, and sometimes, you know, and you'll see it on set. I've had to pull, you know, actors off to the side that are veterans that are getting like frustrated and with the writing, and it's like, hey, I totally get where you're coming from, but this is not how you do it. Like, you got to go like there is a way of talking to a creative, but you just can't show up and be like, duh, duh, duh. Like, yeah, that's not what happened. Duh, 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 duh. And I've always said, you know, like to the guys, you know, especially to the guys, and I'm starting to say it more to the industry to kind of get like a sense of me and my writing style, is that there's three ways to write this kind of genre. There is literal, artistic license, and then pure artistic imagination. To the guys that are in the military or in the veteran community, you want literal, go make a fucking documentary. I love you. I'll support it, but we're not here for the literal. We're here for the hero's journey. We're here for act structure. I need tension. Like, some things kind of have to get bent for that artistic license. But then at the same time too, I do understand the frustration when they watch something where it's like, no way in hell would that ever freaking happen. But the reason why they wrote that was to get to a place that kind of could happen. It was just, how did they get there? That was like, okay, like, and that's like, oh, like, I wish I could have like gotten to the writer's room or talked to a producer. Like, I get what you're trying to do. Let me help you fix that real quick. And then, it's, but at the same time, like, there's so many veteran artists coming out lately that I do feel like, I don't know, man, like, I've always like lived in a dream or a fantasy that like eventually a veteran wave movement will happen. And it could completely change that style of the genre. Because as of right now, we're still stuck in that glorification, romanticizing. We're not actually going past the two-dimensional of the veteran. Like, what is their life? What do they think? What do they feel? What do they love? Not only that, too, let's throw in something else, like an LGBT character. Or even then, let's throw in some, you know, a minority character dealing with racism. You really don't see that as an A plot. You almost see it as like the low tension C plot that kind of gets talked about, when in fact, like, no, like, that should actually be a story completely about itself. So yeah, no, I mean, things are happening. I mean, I hope that, I hope I get to be a part of it.
And I mean, I think that the audience at large and the public at large would respond to the truth quite well, right? Like we do crave it. And, you know, not everyone pays attention to the news and not everyone pays attention to what goes on in the world. So yeah, there are some people who their idea of service is just, I'll be biased and say dumb movies that they saw growing up, you know? So it's like, you know, I won't name anything, but
sure. Yeah, I get it. But I get
when
it.
You talk about a veterans movement, I do get kind of excited for it, because just like, I think, I care about politics a bit, and it feels like there's a veteran, because the, I'll make air quotes, war on terror has been going on since 2002, basically, right? 2001, like the number of veterans, you know, they're in Congress now, right? There's a movement of veterans running for office, which I think is going to help make the world a better place, because who better to be involved in decision-making than people who understand the consequences of political decision-making?
Sure. Yeah. And especially, like, you know, some of those veterans, you know, I love them, my political veterans, but even then we'll even have discussions about some political veterans about how, like, you know, they're leaning so far to a side that they're almost forgetting the community and also, like, the things that we fought for. Like I say it all the time, I fought for free speech, not your speech. Like, that's how this works. Like, you know, I mean, that could be a whole separate podcast in itself.
For sure. I mean, actually what you said, and it's a great note, is that veterans are human beings, and some might go into politics or acting or creating and just completely buy in and just become a politician instead of remembering where they came from. And yeah, obviously that can happen, but there could be, you know, there could have been someone in that writer's room who didn't bother saying, you know, I'd rather get my check than correct what this showrunner is trying to push.
Yeah, no, I don't know how many times I've been to a festival Q&A, and, you know, it's I really talked about war film, and they'll say, like, well, what did you do for research for that veteran authenticity? And they'll be like, well, I read the book. And I'm like, fucking A, bro, you read the book. Like, and it's just like I can just, like, turn around to the fellows behind me, like, hey, did you hear that, guys? You read the book. Like, you know, but, you know, like, because, like, and this is, like, something that I think some people, I think one of the things that that veteran artists are really trying to push right now, and for people to understand, is that veterans, it is an identity, it is a community, and it does have a voice. And I don't know, I've actually been at festivals where people have challenged me on panels about that. It totally happens. And I don't really understand it. Like, it just happened recently at a different festival. Not that I was part of the panel, but one of my friends, he was really trying to make the point, and he got really upset afterwards. And he was like, I just don't understand why people can't look at us and view us as a community with a voice. Like, it is an identity to us. It may not be an identity to some of us, but to a lot of us, it is our identity. And I was like, hey, that's your next script right there, brother. And, you know, so you just got to keep on pushing and keep on pushing. And we always say, like, a lot of the work that we're doing now, it's not for us. I'm just going to flat out say it. A lot of people disagree with me on this, but anybody that's in the industry knows it takes 7 years to make a film. It takes so much time to make an actual, you know, mainstream budget movie. And unless you're at the indie level, then yeah, like, you know, elves do magic at night. You can just do it overnight. But when you're doing something that has, you know, lots of impact on the community and everything like that, it does take time. So people are going to say, like, well, then why are you writing this stuff and making this stuff now? It's like, well, it's for the next generation of veterans coming in. You know, there's not many of us left. You know, 22 a day has been a thing for a very long time. And, you know, I was talking to somebody else about this. Well, you know, Joe Biden just had a speech, and the number's down to 17. And I'm like, well, you know, the VA just did a research study that half of the veterans that are eligible for the VA actually use it. they're very distrustful of the government. So that 17 is only representing half of the entire veteran community that is even eligible for the VA. And you're not taking into account your veterans that got kicked out. Literally, one of my friends, 3 days, because he got caught smoking spice. Not even marijuana. He got caught smoking spice, and he was dishonorably discharged, which is insanity to me, because he was in one of the most, you know, horrible eras of the war. Like, my unit alone, we have naval unit citation, a meritorious unit citation. We got a presidential unit citation from Obama. And in our country, you have people literally using medicinal marijuana to help them with their post-traumatic stress disorders. One of my friends, he didn't even know it then, but he does know it now. Like, yeah, that's what I was basically doing. And within those 3 days, he gets completely cut off. No mental health services, no types of help from the government. Oh, yeah, no, like, it's like, so you're talking about also those people that are not allowed into the VA system. Yeah, no, I mean, like, there are so many things that you could write and talk about. And yeah, that was one of my rants right there.
And it's a great rant. I mean, it's the word rant should be a compliment, right? Because you're saying it because it's a value, and it is such a challenging situation that and of course, God, we know what happens with massive bureaucracies, and if someone gets mistreated 3 days, 3 days away from having at least some basic services for life. I mean, Lord knows it's not the solution, but
yeah, well, it also goes down into the veteran. I mean, the military community itself, like, every now and then you do get a leader that wants to make an example to, like, set the tone for the base. And it was just so happened my buddy got screwed over like that. I mean, we all wrote pages, and like, cause you can write little things to send to command to take into consideration. And I was a corporal at the time, so a non-commissioned officer. And yeah, and it didn't do anything for us. But then you have those good leaders, where one of my buddies, you know, we lost 5 guys in one day. And one of my friends, one of the five, that was one of his best friends. And when we got back, I just remember one thing that I knew my buddy was not doing well. He got an entire back mural piece. Like, I'm talking like to the top of his neck, all the way down to his lower back, upper butt area. And he sat in the chair for 12 hours to get at least the stenciling done. And I was like, hey, you want to talk about it? And he's like, nah. And I was like, okay. And then like a couple days later, he's throwing a chair through a hotel front window, and anything over $400 is in private property damage is considered a felony. Luckily, my buddy had two things going for him. One, the hotel, they knew exactly what our unit just went through, so they were in complete consideration. And hey, nobody got hurt. We're not going to press charges. So, like, if anything, take care of the guy. And then my officer, you know, he stepped in and said, hey, I'm not going to give you anything but a page 11, which is basically a slap in the hand, but you're going to go see the base therapist and you're going to talk about it. And that, to me, is a good leader, hands down. Not making him an example. Like, he literally went through some really traumatic stuff. You know, don't take away things from him just because he's literally being a human being. I mean, think about it at your own work office place. If somebody gets in trouble for addiction or for violence, they send them to like 5 different rehabs before they freaking fire the guy, right? And then in the military, they'll just straight up just like cut you right then and off. And you're like, oh my God, I literally just sat in a chair and just had violent images flash in front of my eyes, like I'm in a Clockwork Orange, and I'm not going to get any type of validation or even help when I get out. Like, yeah, no, it's a completely messed up, broken process that veteran artists today are really, that's like one of the focuses of the plethora of things that we're trying to write about.
Yeah. I mean, it must be really hard when you sit down to create to not deal with these subjects, because like you said, it's an identity. I mean, when you say it's an identity, I mean, I just want to point out that, like, in the general world, people develop a fucking identity because they go to a school for 2 to 4 years and they like identify with that school for the next 50 years. And that ain't that intense, you know? So, yeah. I mean, how could people not, how could it not completely become a part of your soul, having gone through such an intense experience with other human beings? Like, it would have to be your identity. Like, and of course the no escape from it is part of the problem or part of the difficulty.
Yeah. I think it really comes down to some people seeing it as they were part of the government. Now they're writing work. Is this, are we getting into the realm of propaganda piece? Are we going to, and I understand that. I completely understand that. But at the same time too, you know, when you come in and you see one of our pieces, just come in with an open mind at first. Just come at it with an open mind. Obviously, if it is a propaganda piece, man, hit me up and let me talk to that guy. I'll yell at him myself. Like, why are you doing this? You're going to be giving all of us a bad name right now. And then if you do come in with an open mind and you see just that experience of what all of these men, women, people are just going through, it could actually change a lot of things. Like veterans have been part of the world and their community. The community has been part of society, and we have influenced it on so many different realms, from literally the word trigger coming out of the VA to, you know, Winnie the Pooh. Like, all of those things have come out of the veteran community. So it's just, yeah, I understand people's difference towards it, but if anything, just give us a chance, give us a shot, you know. Come see our stuff.
For sure. And I mean, well, it's an example of one, but I mean, if I were to speak of wars, is certainly just a personal human story, and it's not propaganda, and it's not, I guess it might be persuasive, but really what it is it's just an emotional human story.
Yeah.
And people will get from it what they will, but at least what they're also getting is some truth.
Yeah. Thank you for saying that. Yeah. No, what is it? You know, when I was writing that, I really wanted to think about, you know, why does someone like Hemingway come back and write? Why does the five directors of World War II come back and go into film? You know, why did they do things like that? Like, what inspires them? Like Tim O'Brien. So, you know, setting up his frustrations, him feeling isolated, alienated, listening to the community, and just that overall frustration of just being like, hey, you know, in the beginning, you all wanted this. You literally sent us there to do it. And now you're acting like you're ashamed about it and you can't even talk about it, which means you can't even talk to me, you know, fuck you. Like, you know, it's like you can't just sit there and be like, change of mind, you know, because I can't change my mind from the memories that I've seen. And that's just one veteran opinion about the global war on terror. So it was kind of like, that was really the trigger device to get our silent actor to go out there and write something. So it was definitely a lot of fun. You know, I think one of my proudest moments, in that short film, the VA group therapy session, everybody in that shot is a veteran. And I just love the diversity of that shot, because you literally have guys in there with like dyed pink hair. You have women, you have people of color. Like, you literally have the backdrop of what the veteran community actually looks like. So it was one of my proudest moments as a producer.
For sure. And bravo. Yeah. It's funny. You almost want to freeze frame and go, everyone here, like, you want to break the fourth wall and go, by the way, you're looking at the truth for a change. Cause casting. I mean, it's such an interesting time, because actually the entertainment industry is starting to realize, well, they've gotten their ass kicked as in the last few years when they do a true disservice in casting, whether it's ethnic or racial or gender, it's sexual preference, whatever. Yeah. Like the world, it's not that actors can't play things that they are not, but if you have the choice of at least having the person represent the truth, you know, then it's a really nice time for that.
Oh yeah. It's definitely that point of view. And also I just think that, I mean, I don't know why the industry was so apprehensive with it at first, because I think now they're absolutely addicted to it because of what diversity actually means, especially in the writer's room. Like, if I literally get everybody that is the same carbon copy, I have like my three staff writers, my one junior writer, and then I got my one showrunner, and they're all carbon copies, you're literally going to get the same script, the same writing, the same point of view every single time. And that is not going to be a good show just because of that fact. So like, when you do diversity in the writer's room and you start getting those different points of views, like, yeah, this guy is our punch up line guy. And then that girl over there, she will give you 100 ideas. She will just throw things at the wall. And then you got the one person literally sitting in the corner. They don't really say much, but when they do say something, holy crap, everybody listen. Yeah, it's having that diversity that is really going to, I mean, I know everybody says that we're in a golden age of television right now, but I actually think we're on the cusp of something even greater, because this is all happening now, really the industry trying to correct those wrongs from the past. And once it starts getting pushed more forward into the fold, and you're getting out those talented creatives that have never had a shot before, or even that point of view, it's going to completely bring a whole fresh new idea of storylines, characters. It might actually be a renaissance within itself, if not the wave movement of all wave movements.
It could be amazing, and it could hopefully it would, at a certain level, I guess this is hyperbole, but it could rescue the industry. It could rescue the arts, because the arts are in a, always, particularly in this country, the arts are underserved and under-respected, because it's, you know, if I hear all the time from filmmakers overseas how there is public support, and there is, you know, I mean, it's not always the best rising to the top, but, you know, there's people who write a great script and submit it to the film commission, and they just get the money it takes to make that film, instead of, you know, here it's old and trite, but it's true that, you know, if someone's going to give you money for a film, they're going to give you an opinion, and they're going to tell you who to cast, and they're going to, you know, dollars come strings.
Yeah, I mean, there has to be some give and take. Like, I've definitely been moving up since we first met, and I'm now like crazy. I have my own people that I'm mentoring now, which is so insane to me, because I've had so many mentors my whole life. Now I have people me asking questions, and you know, and I always tell them, you know, if you don't like what you don't have to say yes to everything. You really don't. But at the same time, too, if you really don't like everything, great. Go get your own $50 million. That is literally how you do it. You have to play ball. Like the era of the auteur is kind of dying right now. Like, you have so many people coming in, and they're extremely talented. Like, they did not want to become the writer director. They wanted to literally become the greatest cinematographer of all time. Like, that was their go-to point. And you have everybody like that in their own little categories. So it's kind of like, you do have to play a little bit with that. And I know writers, you know, they can sometimes, you know, push back and forth with it and feel like, you know, I don't know if I want to necessarily say yes to this. Okay, great. Like, always say to yourself, the thing that I'm saying I'm saying yes to, is it going to hurt the overall project? Is it in some way going to lessen it? If it's just going to change it into a little bit of a different direction, but it's still at that threshold, then of course, like, just go with it. Like, that's what happens. But at the same time, you get to that no part, like, yeah, this is going to hurt it, then that is the no, that the hill that you're going to die on. Because once you do say no, you know, it's going to go to the top, and then like bigger, way bigger people, definitely the gatekeeper is going to get involved, and then they're going to look at it and they're going to be like, who the hell made this suggestion? And then you will be known for saying the right no. It's not saying no to everything. You got to know when to say the right yes and right no's. And that comes up a lot with experience. So, that's what I would say to a young, you know, an artist trying to go and be successful at this and try to find some type of stable work that you have to learn to give and take. You just have to. That auteur era is kind of over. I mean, we do have some with, you know, Jordan Peele and Darren Aronofsky, but at the same time, it's kind of like, I don't know. I mean, I think it might be done and over unless somebody comes out of nowhere that just completely changes things.
I mean, there's always exceptions, but it's always based upon like a breakout, unexpected hit or something.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's, but for every, yeah, I remember I was a huge fan of John Sayles way back in the 80s. And I, the smartest thing I've ever heard a director say was an interviewer said to him, I don't remember if it was a Q&A or what, might have just been in a newspaper article. They said, you know, you inspire a lot of the young people, this and that. And he said, I don't think they want to write like me. I don't even know if they want to make films like me. They just want the freedom I have. And the only reason I have freedom is that I'm able to, like, I work in budgets low enough that I can be in control. And I was like, wow, he knows it. Like, it's not that people are looking at his career and going, ah, I want to be the next John Sayles. They just looked at a guy who was creating and getting things made, and they're like, I want to create and get things made. It's kind of funny. Yeah, the auteur thing is, it's normally about a trust fund. I guess that's me being, being a well too experienced cynic or whatever, but normally the amount of freedom you have comes from your lack of how little you have to struggle to have food and board.
Oh yeah. And when I first started out in the indie phase, like literally like what is it, like this film, If I Were Speaker of War, that was $500. That's how much I spent on that thing. And I was literally wearing not several but seven hats on that. And then when I started climbing, you know, more hats came off and more hats are coming off. And now I'm really just writer producer. And I feel like it's almost like that control can sometimes be like a make or break for you, where it's like, yeah, I have it now and I don't want to give that up. Like, I love being able to manipulate this and manipulate that. And if that's the case, that, you know, if you're listening to this and you're all about that, then you need to find the right people that know how to speak your language, because not everybody's going to roll with that. And that's totally fine too. Like, I don't know why some artists are like, oh yeah, I'll never work with that person because they do this and this. And it's like, kidding me? I would totally work with that person once to get the experience of what it's like to see what they do, their point of view. But then again, too, like, it's just not my style, but it was really interesting how they went about this process, how they did it. Yeah, I'm just a lover of art, point of view, how you go about things and do it. I mean, I rarely trash films, because even bad films are art, you know? Like, The Room will always be one of the greatest movies, in my opinion, because it's just like one of those movies where it was a pure happy accident movie. And, you know, like what is it, a Disaster Artist? I think it was J.J. Abrams. He's like, yeah, you take the top five comedic directors of today and you'll never make that movie. You'll never be able to make it. It's just impossible to make what they did. And who's to say that movie is trash when, oh, you were a numbers guy? You better believe it is making a lots of money. Artistically, yeah, it is definitely inspired a lot of movies since. So, like, I'm not going to say it's trash. I'm actually going to say it did what it wanted to do. It had legs and it moved.
For sure. In fact, for me, I pride myself a little bit on the fact that for at least, honestly, for many decades, I've never, ever said something's bad. I say it's not for me. Like,
yeah, exactly.
And honestly, like, look, the biggest movie probably for a long time is going to be Top Gun Maverick. And I just tell everyone, oh, hey, they don't need me to go see that movie. Like, that movie wasn't made for me. I'm not too interested in it. And I know I might even enjoy it, but like, hey, they didn't make it for me. They don't need me. I'm like, I'm not shitting on it. I'm not saying it's bad.
Yeah.
I'm just saying I saw the first one in high school and I got some problems with it as a work of art, but hey, people love it and they love the revisitation of it. And great, because it turns out there's a lot of people not like me. So it's fine.
Well, I haven't even seen the first one, let alone, the sequel. And, you know, if anything, you know, I was like, literally when you're talking
about it. By the way, it's probably the one military-esque film that the person who wanted you to route, that's their source material.
Yeah, that's their source material, exactly. No, I was actually like thinking when that movie came out, like I love how this year the most propagandist movie came out at the same time the most anti-war film came out at the same time. You have Top Gun and All Quiet on the Western Front. I just thought it was just mind-blowing those two films were in theaters at the same time. And I forgot the second thing I was gonna say, but no, Maverick, you know, when people want to like talk down about Top Gun, like even Steven Spielberg said that movie might have saved the entire movie theater industry all by itself, and it's actually lit the spark for the industry to move forward outside of COVID. So if you're listening to this and you're like, I hate that film, I'll never say anything good about it, like take into consideration that it might have saved the things that we love and adore. And if I didn't have it in my life, I don't know what I would do. I'd be back getting out of the military all over again.
For sure. And the spectacle film, the huge budget spectacle action film, Marvel kept it going for a while. Now Maverick has showed up. But yeah, I mean, well, Spielberg is a funny case because, of course, he and his friends created the blockbuster syndrome that we are now in.
Yeah.
And, you know, Lord knows. But I actually want to focus back on you because you talked about taking off the hats and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Like, are you, what's your focus now? Like, are you, because you mentioned writer's rooms and things, like, are you finding that the door opened a bit for you? And
yeah, no, what is it? So right now I'm doing a lot of writing. I haven't got myself into a room just yet, but I'm definitely have made a lot of connections. I'm doing really well in festivals right now coming from those opening of the doors. So if this comes out in September, I think I could talk about it. Rain Dance. I submitted a pilot. I got a 9.6 out of a 10 for my judges' scores on that. So I have a feeling that's going to do really well this year, even though the year just started. Like doors are opening. I'm meeting showrunners myself and just building that connections, picking their brain, and really learning that one of my favorite things coming out of, you know, the low indie side where I was doing everything, I call it the junior phase, where it's just like you were that young producer, that young entrepreneur, really putting everything together. There's a lot of things you have to deal with artistic temperament that you just have to deal with at that low phase. And I think it could actually break a lot of people where it's like, oh my God, like I can't imagine once I get higher, it's going to be like this. And once I broke that ceiling, it was like I took in a breath of just absolute fresh air. I was meeting people that wanted to help me. They were completely just professional. There's an HR department. Of course, they're going to be professional. Like it was just amazing to be in that place of where like, yeah, like the industry actually wants to help people. It actually does. You just have to put yourself out there and be like, hey, can I get a cup of coffee with you? Could I pick your brain about something? And always come in with a specific question. Because if you come in saying, how do I become an actor? They're just going to look at you like, well, go read a book. But if you say like, how do I become a successful actor on 3 camera setup sound stages as a character actor? Oh, wow. Okay, great. I'll sit you down. I'll tell you exactly what I'm seeing right now in the industry. So having those specific questions coming from that experience of being at the indie level and just having that air of professionalism around you. It's been an amazing feeling finally getting to the place where I'm at right now. Yeah.
That's excellent. That's excellent. And you know, I think it says a lot about your focus too and your dedication.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I've always been that way. Like I write 3 scripts a year. I tell that to my friends and they think I'm absolutely psycho. Like there's no way you write 3 scripts a year. And I was like, oh, you want me to send you one when I'm done? And then literally what I like to do is 2 months I give myself 2 months to write something. And then I take a month off, 2 months, month off, and I just keep on that writing. And I kind of came up with this technique just because OWAs, open writing assignments, they only give you 8 to 10 weeks to write those things. And then there's like this, and then there's a, for people that don't know, there's like a little check things that you have to go to, like, so that they give you $40,000 to write this feature film. You're not going to get a flat check of $40,000. You're going to write that beat sheet first, and then you're going to write your outline, and then you're going to start getting your first draft. And every time you get there and they okay it, that's when you get your money. So I just started getting into that routine myself of like, okay, great. If this is what the industry is right now, as much as I would love to have a year or 2 years or 3 years to write something, I'm never going to make money. I have to get used to writing at this fast pace and just going out there and doing it. Of course, I have my side projects that I do give a little bit more TLC to, but at the same time, you know, you have to go to the speed of what the industry is doing. It's kind of like going back to what we were talking about taking away those hats and being able to say yes to things just because of the fact that, yeah, like I can't say no to everything, because eventually at some point someone's going to tell me, get your own 50 million, you can go make it. So you have to get to that place of where the industry is going and keep speaking their language, being at that speed, which, you know, it can be incredibly hard. I mean, I had to force myself to literally sit down sometimes and be like, 250 words a day. That's what we're going to do. Even if it's just gibberish, I will use it for something. I swear to God.
Well, and what you're saying is so important for a creative, which is you can't be precious about it, because you're not going to sit down and write a perfect 250. You just got to get it done. Like you're, yeah. I mean, you know, I'm a little crude, so I always saw, you know, I'm like, just shit or get off the pot. Like you just got to take that shit, and then you can actually start doing something with it in rewrites or this or that. But exactly. nothing freezes a creative more than like, I'm going to write one version of this and it's going to be perfect. I'm like, that's just, it's nonsense. Like you don't even write through, you discover the material by writing it.
Exactly. And not only that too, when you get to that level, you have more access. Like you're going to have people, they're like literally waiting to do coverage on your stuff. And you're going to be having tons of people giving you notes about what you think. And I'm so glad I started out the way I did, because I've been able to learn that wonderful gift of knowing the difference between this is an industry note, you can't do this, and preference. Because preference is literally like, okay, yeah, you're not my demographic. Yeah, that's okay. That's all right. I'm not going to listen to that. Whereas in the industry note, I do have to listen to that. Like that is something that is specific. I can't necessarily do that. If anything, I got to switch it and change it up and everything like that. And it's definitely been a process. But at the same time too, like I'm still, you know, doing, you know, indie films, talking to my indie friends that are still like, yeah, I'll never leave this. I really want to be here for the rest of my life. And, you know, we talk about projects that we could potentially do and everything like that. And so sky's the limit.
Yeah. And it's nice that you got that balance too. And Lord knows, I mean, big names have that balance too, but it's nice to hear you have that. Yeah, I mean, you might find yourself at some point going, okay, let's just do something absolutely insane that we can get done in one weekend. And
yeah, and that for me came from a place of being an actor. I always believed that it comes from Philip Seymour Hoffman, I think he has this quote where he said, if you can't perform in somebody's living room in Brooklyn, you have no business performing on Broadway. And I feel the same exact way. If you have not the ability within you to write a $1,000 short film, then you, in my opinion, have no business writing the big budget projects. Like you don't understand what it's like to know when your line producer is giving those notes of like, yeah, this is going way outside the budget. Or at the same time too, like, hey, you're like writing pretty, you know, boxy. Like, we can do more with this if you want to, like, punch it up and everything like that. But at the same time, too, you know, everybody has their own preference and style of, like, how they want to be and everything like that. But it goes to the point of learning how to write in multiple places with multiple facets, multiple lenses. It'll only make you better, just as much as why does the photographer study ballet and why does the ballet artist study carpentry? All art speaks to one another. So you should be open to that idea and getting that kind of experience.
You know, it's a beautiful thing. And art is a, art matters. It always has. Art matters. I think it's, you know, it's funny because in the USA, sometimes, I don't know, sometimes there are people who don't believe it matters, but it's just art, and particularly the art of storytelling, I always say, is it's just intrinsic to humanity. It's you know, when we were hunter-gatherers, we did what it took to survive, and then at night we sat around a campfire and talked about it, you know, and shared stories, and like, our brains evolve for storytelling. Like, that's why we find storytelling so compelling. Like, we actually really do need it. Like, and maybe, you know, in the mid 1900s, it was write the great American novel. And then second half of the century, people started wanting to write the great, you know, screenplay. And now I don't know, but we need it. We absolutely need it. It's not just fluff.
Yeah, and where it goes forward, I absolutely believe this diversity push is going to really pull away some of that mist and create it transparent of where the industry is going to go. And I completely agree with you. Going back to that hunter-gatherer phase, like, if anything, it reminded me of those times when I was in a foxhole in Afghanistan and you are literally waiting for Haji to show up and you're there with your buddies and it's like, all right, anybody got a story or a joke or anything? And I'll say it to the day I die. Like, I have never laughed and I have never cried harder than I ever have than I did while I was in Afghanistan. And it was just those moments of just oral storytelling or just having that experience. And even that wonderful art of letter writing, that in itself is, you know, kind of like the beginning, moments of, you know, having your first writing lesson, sitting down and actually writing out the words and really thinking about it. I was just like thinking of some of the stories that I've heard. Like, we had this one guy, just to be real quick, I'll never freaking forget him. Let's just call him Frank. I don't want to say his real name, but Frank was a liar. Frank lied all the freaking time. And it was amazing, some of his lies. Like, to this, like it was just, some of the things that he would come up, it was just amazing. And now I remember just like being on post. I've been up for like 48 hours. I got to stand post for 6 hours. It's midnight. My body is literally telling me to go to sleep. I got to stay awake. You get the radio and like, hey, Frank, tell me a story about back home that I just haven't heard yet. And Frank's like, well, did I ever tell you about the time me and my daddy graduated high school at the same time? No, Frank. I've never heard the time about you graduating high school with your dad. Like, tell me the story. And he would just go off. And it was just like, I'm never going to forget this. I'm never going to forget this guy and all the stupid stories that he told me. And then everything else coming with that. So I guess you could say that's where I got my first lesson in writing and acting and just the whole arts in itself, was just literally the guys. We have no cameras. We have no computers, we have no laptops. We're just telling each other, you know, the art of storytelling, oral storytelling. Yeah.
I was gonna ask you, I mean, were you a storyteller before that experience, or do you think you actually discovered your skill for storytelling? Because in your what you consider long, but I consider a brief bio, right? You didn't talk about like being a storyteller or like writing stuff, you know, as a kid, like free service, pre-Marines.
Yeah, I would say, you know, I think I had the interest, because I always knew that I wanted to be an actor. I wanted to do something. So I had the interest there. But because of my self-confidence issues growing up, I never did anything about it. So if I didn't go into the military, I don't think I would be doing this. I probably would have done something that would have fitted my confidence level where I could be at. And so, yeah, I think going in the military totally triggered that for me. And not only that too, like I'm absolutely in love with these guys. And I tell them all the time, cause like, you know, I'll go to veteran reunions and, you know, they'll hear about my struggles or they'll hear about the things I'm doing, the uphill battles, besides all the good things. And then they'll tell you, they'll ask you like, why are you doing this? Like, it's like, you're smart, you're intelligent. Why aren't you doing something else? And I'm like, well, I don't want anybody to ever forget you guys ever. And then they're just like, oh man, we're getting me all misty eyed, you know? And it's like, yeah. So I think the trigger definitely happened in the military, but that passion really came from the human experiences that I met while I was in the military. And it looked nothing like the films that I saw. It looked nothing like the television I saw. You know, like my friends who were gay in the military and they were closeted, but then they came out after the military. I haven't seen anything like that on film, or just all the other kind of stories that have been out there. I want that representation for the community. So that way, when the next generation comes in, hopefully, you know, they can look at that and they can empathize with it and they can say like, yeah, that's me. I know where to go. Because one of my biggest problems with the veteran story in film is so many of it does not have a happy ending for the hero. I mean, I don't know how many times I've seen a veteran movie where the veteran does not at all go anywhere in life. It ends on a sad note, a depressing note. It's basically a Greek tragedy from the very get-go. And I'm not saying all the stories that I write are going to have some type of ending, but there has to be meaning in that suffering, at least for them to be able to move forward with their lives. Cause then you're just going to be telling your actual audience member, the actual demographic that this represents, that you are in a perpetual state of depression for the rest of your existence.
You know, I mean, I wish as a powerless person sitting in a home office in Southern California, I hope the way the universe works out is the powers that be like recognize that what you have to offer has this value, and that the public at large, I think, is so ready for the truth. Like we've had the bullshit and we've had the propaganda for so long, but I think we're finally aware. Like we went through so much as a culture, right? Like,
yeah,
I'm a huge fan of history, so you know, I'm well aware that the veterans of World War One and Two came back and PTSD was just called shell shock, and the job was just to drink your pain away and never speak of it. And now your generation, you know, and Lord knows what happens to, you know, the guys who went to Korea and Vietnam, and then your generation goes to the Middle East. And I feel like there's change afoot. Like, I feel like every generation is not getting what they need, but we're getting closer.
Oh yeah, definitely.
There's less, I don't know what the exact word is, but there's less, I don't know.
There's definitely more traction. And I can tell you why, is because I know you're saying, you know, the powers may be, you guys definitely are the powers may be, the indie level, you know, taking in veteran art, this like, you know, these rising performers, actors, writers, whatever it may be, you know, taking them and seeing them and say like, there is something here. There is a level of truth here that I have not seen, and pushing it forward. Like I've always said, like, I don't look towards the commercial side or the mainstream side of what the film world is doing. I always look at the indie level. Like what is the indie artist doing? Cause they're going to set the tone of what the future will always be. And it's always been like that since the new wave movement, in my opinion, with the 1960s and 70s. So doing little things like this, thank you so much. Because if anything, it's not what you know, it's who you know. And if more people are talking about it and more people are asking for the desire of it, oh yeah, that puts it out there.
Excellent. Well, anything you want to add in before we jump off and then jump back on?
Yeah, absolutely. If anybody has been listening to me and wants to follow me more or even hit me up and ask me questions, you can follow me on Instagram at mattydomenico.com. And I also have my website if you just want to check out some of the past stuff I've done or even the future stuff that I'm going to be going on towards. It's mattydomenico.com.
And I will, for sure, those will be clickable links in the show notes of the podcast. Both your Instagram and your website, I'll make sure they're both on there. And excellent. All right. Well, I'll do the aforementioned wrap up, which is thank you everyone for listening. This is the Discover Indie Film Podcast that pretty much just was born out of film festivals. It's just talking to people who are on the film festival circuit. Lord knows, knock on wood, Matthew Domenico, 5 years, 10 years, I don't know what, but hopefully you'll be a household name and people will be like, people Google your name and they'll get to hear you like talking about life and career like right now when you're still an indie festival guy. So I don't know. I love that idea. Hopefully, like I said, it'll happen.
I love it too.
And, so please like and subscribe to the podcast. Write a review if it's a good one. Don't be a dick. And if you want to learn more about the podcast or the TV series that was born out of it, which in season 9 we're going to have If I Were to Speak of War, which is a great title, by the way. But just go to discoverindiefilm.com and on social media, it's at DIFWINS. We talked about both festivals that Matthew had scripts as official selections at. That's Film Invasion Los Angeles is every June. And it's filminvasionla.com and at filminvasionla on social media. Sherman Oaks Film Festival, it's Sherman Oaks. We hold that one every November and it's ShermanOaksFF.com and it's at ShermanOaksFF on social media. And I mentioned at the top that, heck, Matthew and I got into this an email convo about If I Were to Speak of War. So thanks to TV High made it happen. So if you, like I said at the top, if you're a responsible drug user, don't let drugs hurt you, man. They can really hurt a person. But if you got a handle on it, and actually, if you just enjoy indie film anyway, trust me, TV High, everything on there is great if you're not high. But if you go to watchtvhi.com, and it's at watchtvhi on all social media, it's fucking great stuff. And it's got a little something special to it that if you add a little THC or whatever your body enjoys, it's even better. And actually, we had a guy when we had a live screening last year on 4/20/2022, and a guy came and goes, "Oh no, I don't. I brought a 6-pack of beer because that's how I want to enjoy this." And he enjoyed the films as much as all the stoners. So what can I say? I guess I'm still trapped in that mode of most of my life. You know, drugs were like demonized, and this was everything was criminalized in this country. And now we're finally, you know, I don't realize how normal it is for the generations below me, because I'm middle aged. You know, I don't realize that everyone's like, you don't have to make apologies for the weed channel. So anyway, I guess I've said what I need to say. Matthew, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And for everyone listening, thank you for listening to this podcast. The next podcast after this one that'll come out a few days after will be Matthew answering the 4 questions so we get to know his opinions on films. It'll be all about his favorite films and maybe some that aren't favorites, but we'll see. All right. Thanks again. And thank you everyone for listening. Yeah.